A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's pointing at something that sits right in the middle of the publishing world. This weird zone between the prestige of a traditional house and the anything goes freedom of self-publishing. Companies that look like real publishers on the outside, but underneath, they're pay-for-play operations. You pay them, they publish you. And the question is, what does that do to the signal a published book is supposed to send?
It's not a small question anymore because the book as business card model has exploded since 2020. Every consultant, every executive coach, every aspiring thought leader wants a book on their shelf, literally on their shelf at the back of the stage, propped up on an easel during the keynote. And an entire industry has evolved to sell them exactly that.
The book as stage prop, which is actually the perfect way into this, because if the book is a prop, the publisher is a prop maker. And some prop makers are more honest than others.
So let's lay out the landscape, because this middle ground only makes sense when you see what's on either side of it. On one end, you've got the Big Five. Penguin Random House, HarperCollins, Macmillan, Simon & Schuster, Hachette. These are traditional, advance-paying publishers. They pay you for the rights to your book. They take the financial risk. And because of that, they're selective. They reject roughly 99% of unsolicited manuscripts.
99%. So if you get through that door, it actually means something.
On the other end, you've got true self-publishing. Amazon KDP, Ingram Spark, Draft 2 Digital. You do everything yourself, or you hire freelancers for editing and cover design, but you're the publisher. You control the ISBN, you keep all the rights, you set the price, it's transparent. Nobody's pretending anything.
Then there's the middle.
These are companies that present themselves as publishers. They have logos that look like colophons, they have submission guidelines, they talk about being selective. But the economic model is inverted. Instead of them paying you, you pay them. Upfront fees, mandatory marketing packages, bundled services. The average full-service package in 2025 to 2026 runs between $5,000 and $15,000, with premium packages exceeding $25,000.
The money flows from author to publisher, not publisher to author. That's the tell.
That's the fundamental tell. And it changes everything about the incentives. A traditional publisher makes money by selling books to readers. A pay-for-play publisher makes money by selling publishing services to authors. The reader is almost irrelevant to their business model.
Which means the editorial filter, the thing that's supposed to separate good books from bad, that disappears. If your customer is the author, not the reader, you have no incentive to reject anyone.
They generally don't. The acceptance rate at these houses is north of 95%. The only real gate is whether the author's credit card clears. Jane Friedman, who's been tracking this space for years, did an analysis in 2024 of one of these hybrid publishers, $8,900 for a package that delivered basically a basic ebook conversion and a listing on a distribution channel nobody actually uses.
$8,900 for an ebook conversion. I could nap for 6 months and still produce that.
You could nap for 6 months and produce nothing, which would be functionally equivalent.
So let's talk about the optics, because that's where this gets genuinely interesting. These publishers are sophisticated about replicating the signals of legitimacy. They assign ISBNs. They get Library of Congress control numbers. They produce professional-looking covers. They distribute through Ingram and Baker and Taylor, so the book technically shows up in bookstore databases.
This is where the illusion gets really convincing for someone who doesn't know what to look for. Because if you pull a book off the shelf, or more likely, look at its Amazon listing, you see a publisher name, you see an ISBN, you see a professional cover. It looks indistinguishable from a book published by Simon & Schuster. The ISBN block doesn't tell you who paid whom.
There's a difference between being listed in a database and actually being in a bookstore.
And this is the distribution illusion. Traditional publishers have field sales reps who physically go into bookstores, present the seasonal catalog, negotiate co-op placement. That's when the publisher pays for premium shelf positioning, front-of-store tables, window displays. They send advanced review copies to publishers Weekly and Kirkus and Library Journal months before publication. They manage inventory so bookstores can return unsold copies for full credit.
That's the word, right?
That's the word. And it's one of the biggest invisible signals in the industry. Traditional publishers make their books fully returnable. If a bookstore orders 50 copies and sells 3, they ship the other 47 back at no cost. That's why bookstores are willing to stock unknown authors from known publishers. The risk is on the publisher, not the store.
If I walk into a Barnes & Noble and see a book on the shelf, returnability is the invisible guarantee that got it there.
Now, pay-for-play publishers technically can make books returnable. Ingram offers that option, but most don't, because it costs money and they've already been paid by the author. There's no incentive to take on additional financial risk for a book they don't expect to sell. So the book is available for order, but it's not stocked. It's in the database, not on the shelf.
Available, but invisible. That's a four-word summary of the entire model.
Here's a number that drives it home. Only about 200 books per year from pay-for-play publishers receive reviews in major trade journals. Publishers Weekly, Kirkus, Library Journal. Traditional publishers get roughly 15,000 books reviewed in those same outlets. 200 versus 15,000. The gatekeepers still gatekeep, even if the distribution channel looks open.
The book exists, but it doesn't exist in any of the places where books are discovered by people who matter. Reviewers, bookstore buyers, event planners.
Which brings us to the credentialing question. Because the whole point of publishing a book in this model isn't to sell copies, it's to say you've published a book.
The book as credential. And this is where the history matters. The term vanity press has been around for decades. It used to be a stigmatized label. Authors who paid to publish were seen as failed authors, people who couldn't get through the real gates. But the industry has done a remarkable rebranding job. Now it's hybrid publishing, or author-subsidized publishing, or partnership publishing.
Some of the rebranding is legitimate. There are hybrid publishers that are selective and transparent. She Writes Press is a good example. They're author-funded, but they reject most submissions, they have editorial standards, and they're clear about the model. The problem isn't the model itself. The problem is the deceptive ones that use the hybrid label while operating as a vanity press with better graphic design.
How do you tell the difference? What are the actual signals?
There's a checklist, and it starts with the money. First question, does the publisher pay advances? If the answer is no, full stop, it's not a traditional publisher. Even small advances, $1,000, $2,000, signal that the publisher has skin in the game. Second, what's the acceptance rate? If it's above 50%, there's no meaningful editorial filter. Third, who owns the ISBN? If the author owns it, that's self-publishing. If the publisher owns it, that's a traditional arrangement. But in the pay-for-play world, the publisher owning the ISBN is often just a way to look more legitimate while the author still paid for everything.
The fourth one, which you already mentioned, returnability. If the book isn't returnable to bookstores, it's not going to be stocked.
And there's a subtler signal that most people don't think about. Look at the publisher's other books. If their catalog is a random grab bag, a memoir, a business book, a poetry collection, a sci-fi novel, a cookbook, that's a red flag. Real publishers have lanes. They develop expertise in specific genres and markets. A publisher that does everything is a publisher that does nothing well.
A publisher of everything is a publisher of nothing. So let's talk about who's actually buying this service, because I think there's a misconception that these are all naive authors being scammed.
That's an important point. The misconception is that pay-for-play publishers are preying on clueless first-time authors who don't know any better. And some of that happens, absolutely. But a huge portion of the market is people who know exactly what they're doing. They're making a rational choice in an attention economy. Imagine you're an executive coach. You charge $500 an hour for consulting. You want to break into the keynote speaking circuit, where fees start at $10,000 per appearance and go up from there. A book is your entry ticket. It gives event planners something to put in the program. It gives you a prop for the back of the room sales table. It gives you the phrase author of in your bio.
Which is worth real money.
It's worth real money. And if you can buy that credential for $12,000, and it helps you book even 2 keynote gigs you wouldn't have gotten otherwise, it's paid for itself several times over. That's not being scammed. That's a marketing expense with a positive ROI.
It's not that the author is being deceived. It's that the audience is.
That's the asymmetry. The author knows what they bought. The event planner, the reader, the potential client, they may not. And this is where the signal erosion gets serious.
Walk me through what that means for the broader market.
A book has historically been a costly signal. It was hard to fake because it was hard to produce. Traditional publishing required passing through multiple gates: an agent, an acquisitions editor, an editorial board, a marketing team. Each gate filtered out more people. If you held a book with a recognized publisher's name on the spine, it meant something about the quality and credibility of the content.
Costly signal theory. The signal is reliable because it's expensive to produce.
But when the appearance of that signal becomes purchasable, when anyone with $15,000 can produce something that looks identical to the costly signal, the signal loses its information value. It's like counterfeit handbags. Once the fakes are good enough, the brand itself means less.
In the speaking circuit, this is already happening. Event planners are getting savvier.
They have to. The National Speakers Association ran a survey in 2025 and found that 34% of event planners now check the publisher's advance and royalty structure before booking an author. That's a huge shift. A decade ago, nobody asked those questions. The publisher name on the spine was enough.
A third of event planners are now doing forensic publishing analysis before they book a speaker. That's a sign that the signal is already degrading.
It's not just event planners. Conference organizers, corporate learning and development departments, university speaker series, they're all developing their own vetting processes. Some of them are sophisticated about it. Some of them just Google the publisher name and see what comes up. But the awareness is spreading.
Let's talk about the Amazon dimension, because that's where the feedback loop gets really perverse.
Oh, this is a fascinating piece of the puzzle. So many pay-for-play publishers bundle marketing services into their packages, and one of those services is review generation. They have networks of reviewers, they have systems for soliciting reviews, and the result is that these books can accumulate dozens or even hundreds of Amazon reviews, making them look popular and validated.
You can buy the appearance of popularity on top of the appearance of legitimacy.
You can buy the entire package. The book, the publisher name, the cover, the reviews, the author photo, the media kit. It's a turnkey authority product. And there are executive ghostwriting services now that bundle all of this together. They'll interview you, write the book, package it through a pay-for-play publisher, and deliver you a finished product with your name on the cover for $30,000 to $50,000.
$30,000 to $50,000 for the complete Become a Published Author experience. That's the CEO book phenomenon.
It's not necessarily a bad book. Some of these ghostwriters are excellent. The content might be valuable. But the credentialing mechanism is broken because the publisher's imprint isn't doing any credentialing work. It's just a label.
The book might be good, but the publisher's name tells you nothing about whether it's good, which is exactly the problem. The publisher is supposed to be the filter, and the filter has been removed.
And this connects to something bigger, which is the broader crisis of credentialing in the knowledge economy. We've seen this in higher education with diploma mills. We've seen it in professional certifications with pay-to-certify programs. Book publishing is just the latest domain where the signal and the substance have become decoupled.
The credentialing economy. We've talked about this before, how certifications and degrees function as market signals, and what happens when those signals become purchasable.
Books are a particularly interesting case because they sit at the intersection of multiple markets. A book is a credential in the speaking market, it's a marketing asset in the consulting market, it's a trust signal in the coaching market, and it's a cultural artifact in the ideas market. When you degrade the book as a signal, you're degrading it across all of those domains simultaneously.
What's the regulatory response? Is anyone actually trying to do something about this?
There's movement, but it's slow. The Authors Guild launched something called the Transparent Publishing Initiative in January of this year, calling for mandatory disclosure of author payments on copyright pages. The idea is that if an author paid to publish, that should be stated clearly, the way food labels disclose ingredients.
Like a nutrition facts label for books, this book contains $12,000 in author payments and zero editorial filtering.
That's basically the idea. and there have been pushes for the FTC to get involved, treating deceptive publishing practices as a form of false advertising. But it's tricky, legally, because most of these publishers don't actually lie about what they do. They just use ambiguous language. They say things like, "We partner with authors," or "We offer comprehensive publishing services." They don't say, "We are a traditional advance-paying publisher." The deception is in the omission and the framing, not in explicit false claims.
Which is harder to regulate. You can't sue someone for using the word partnership ambiguously.
And the industry has gotten very good at the language. They've learned from the old vanity press era, when companies like Vantage Press were openly mocked and the stigma was clear. The new generation uses all the right words: curation, selective, traditional quality, while operating the same economic model.
Let's talk about the older generation versus the new one. You mentioned Author House, iUniverse, Ex Libris.
Those are the first wave, and they're still around. Author House was founded in 1997, originally as a digital self-publishing platform. iUniverse launched around the same time. Ex Libris came a bit later. They were the pioneers of the print-on-demand publishing model, and they were fairly transparent about what they were. You paid, they printed. But over time, as the market got more crowded, the branding got more sophisticated.
Now we have a second and third generation of these companies that have learned all the lessons about optics.
They've raised the production values accordingly. The covers look like they came from a Big Five design department. The websites use the same language as traditional publishing: imprints, acquisitions, editorial boards. Some of them even have physical offices in New York, which carries its own symbolic weight.
Nothing says legitimate like a Manhattan address you visit once a year for a photo op.
Here's a detail that most people miss: the ISBN ownership question. In traditional publishing, the publisher owns the ISBN. In self-publishing, the author owns it. In the pay-for-play world, it varies. Some of these companies let the author keep the ISBN, which is actually more transparent because it reveals the self-publishing nature of the arrangement. Others insist on owning the ISBN precisely because it makes them look more like a traditional publisher in industry databases.
Owning the ISBN is part of the costume.
It's part of the costume. And it matters because ISBN ownership determines who shows up as the publisher of record in every database: Bowker, Ingram, Amazon, library catalogs. If you're trying to look like a real publisher, you want your name in that field.
Let's go back to the speaking circuit for a moment, because I think that's where the rubber meets the road for a lot of this. You mentioned the National Speakers Association survey. What does the vetting process actually look like for an event planner who's trying to figure out if an author is legit?
It's still inconsistent, but the sophisticated planners have developed a few go-to checks. First, they look at the publisher. If it's not a name they recognize, they check whether it's an imprint of one of the Big Five or a known independent press. Second, they look at the book's sales rank and review profile. Is there organic engagement, or does it look purchased? Third, and this is the newer one, they ask directly about the publishing arrangement. Some speaker applications now have a checkbox: was your book traditionally published, self-published, or published through a hybrid or author-funded model?
That's how you know the signal has degraded, when you need a checkbox to clarify what the signal was supposed to mean in the first place.
Even that is imperfect, because authors can just lie. But it creates a paper trail. If a speaker claims traditional publishing, and it later comes out that they paid $12,000 for a package, that's a reputation problem.
What's the better path for someone who actually wants to publish a book and have it mean something? You mentioned this earlier. Either true self-publishing or a genuine small press.
And I want to be clear about why the middle ground is the worst of both worlds. If you self-publish, you keep all your rights, you keep all your royalties, which are typically 70% on Amazon versus the 10 to 15% you'd get from a traditional publisher, and you control everything. The trade-off is that you have to do the work of publishing or hire freelancers to do it. But you're not paying someone to pretend to be your publisher.
On the other end, a genuine small press?
A genuine small press pays you in advance, even if it's small. $500, $1,000, $1,000. The advance is the signal. It means the publisher is betting their own money on your book. They have a financial incentive to sell copies, which means they have a financial incentive to only publish books they believe in. That alignment of incentives is what makes the credential meaningful.
The advance isn't just money. It's proof of work. It's the publisher saying, we believe in this enough to risk something.
And that's why the Authors Guild's transparency push focuses on disclosure of payments. If a copyright page said the author paid $12,000 for publication services, that would immediately tell you what the advance-based model tells you implicitly, who had skin in the game, and whose interests the publisher was serving.
Let's talk about where this is heading, because the landscape is shifting fast. You've got AI-generated books flooding the market now. That's a 2026 phenomenon that's only accelerating. Where does the pay-for-play model fit in a world where anyone can generate a book in an afternoon?
That's the open question. In one scenario, the pay-for-play model becomes obsolete because the cost of producing a book-like object drops to near zero. Why pay $12,000 for a publishing package when an AI can generate the text and a template can produce the cover for free?
In another scenario, the pay-for-play publishers adapt and become even more sophisticated. They start offering AI-assisted writing as part of the package, or they position themselves as the quality filter in a sea of AI-generated junk.
I think the second scenario is more likely. The value proposition shifts from, we'll publish your book, to, we'll make your book stand out from the AI-generated noise. They'll sell curation, design, and distribution in a market where the raw production cost has collapsed, and some of them might actually provide real value in that context.
The irony being that they'll be selling curation while not actually curating.
That's the tension, and it raises the question of whether the transparent platforms, the Publish Drives and Draft2 Digitals of the world, will eventually crowd out the deceptive middle ground. These are platforms that say openly, we're a service provider, not a publisher. You pay us for distribution and tools, and you keep your rights and your ISBN. There's no pretense.
The honest service model versus the deceptive publisher model. And the honest one might actually win on economics, because they're not spending money maintaining the fiction.
Draft2 Digital and Publish Drive take a cut of royalties rather than charging large upfront fees, which aligns their incentives with the author's success. They make money when the author makes money. That's a fundamentally different relationship than charging $15,000 upfront and having no stake in whether the book sells.
Let's pull this together into something practical. If you're a listener and you're looking at a book, maybe you're an event planner vetting a speaker. Maybe you're a reader trying to figure out if a business book is worth your time. What's your checklist?
First, check if the publisher pays advances. If they don't, it's not a traditional publisher. Second, look at the submission acceptance rate. If it's above 50%, there's no meaningful editorial filter. Third, verify who owns the ISBN. If the author owns it, it's self-publishing, which is fine, but it means you should evaluate the book on its own merits rather than relying on the publisher's reputation. Fourth, check if the book is returnable to bookstores. Non-returnable inventory means it won't be on shelves.
For the author side, if you're thinking about publishing a book and someone offers you a package deal,
ask yourself what you're really buying. If you want a credential for your consulting practice and you're clear-eyed about what you're getting, a transparent hybrid publisher might serve your needs. But if you want the book to function as a genuine signal of expertise, you need a publisher that has financial skin in the game. Either go traditional and get an advance, or self-publish and be honest about it. The middle ground is where the signal dies.
The book has always been a signal of authority. It's one of the oldest credentials we have. And when that signal becomes purchasable, the real question is, what replaces it?
Whether we're ready for a world where credentials are entirely decoupled from vetting, because books are just one domain. The same dynamic is playing out in academic publishing, in professional certifications, in journalism. Everywhere a credential can be purchased, the information value of that credential drops.
Which means we're all going to have to get better at evaluating substance directly, rather than relying on institutional shortcuts.
That's hard work. It's much easier to see a publisher's logo and a book cover and think, okay, this person is legitimate. Doing the actual vetting, reading the book, checking the publisher's model, looking at the review profile, that takes time and effort.
The alternative is a world where every signal is fake and nobody trusts anything. And that's worse.
Because trust is the whole game. The reason publishing worked as a credentialing system for centuries is that readers and event planners and journalists could outsource their trust to the publisher. They didn't have to evaluate every book from scratch. They could rely on the imprint as a proxy for quality. When that proxy breaks down, the transaction costs go up for everyone.
The pay-for-play publishers are essentially free-riding on the trust that traditional publishers built up over decades. They're borrowing the appearance of legitimacy without doing the work that creates legitimacy.
That's exactly what they're doing. And the only defense is awareness. Knowing the signals, understanding the economics, and being willing to look past the cover.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In 1928, a German historian claimed that the Hanseatic League had a secret trade outpost in Turkmenistan for routing silk through the Caspian. The story was cited in several interwar economic histories before being debunked in 1934. The supposed outpost was a misidentified caravanserai that had nothing to do with the Hansa.
A Hanseatic ghost town in Turkmenistan.
That's going to stick with me. Here's what I keep coming back to. We're in this moment where the cost of producing a book has dropped to effectively zero. The cost of making it look legitimate has dropped to about $12,000, and the value of the book as a credential is simultaneously rising in the attention economy. Those three trends are on a collision course.
The collision is already happening. The question is, what comes out the other side?
My guess is that we'll see a bifurcation. The transparent platforms, the Draft 2 Digitals and Published Drives, will capture the volume market because they offer better economics and no pretense. The traditional publishers will double down on their brand value as curators and gatekeepers, and the deceptive middle ground will get squeezed from both sides.
Or it'll just keep evolving, getting more sophisticated, finding new ways to look legitimate. The history of this industry suggests that the middle ground is remarkably resilient.
That's the less optimistic scenario. But either way, the burden is shifting to the reader, the event planner, the hiring manager, the person on the receiving end of the signal. They're going to have to get smarter about what a book actually means.
Which is probably a good thing, in the long run. Skepticism is a survival skill in an information economy.
And I'd rather have people asking whether a publisher paid in advance than just assuming every book with an ISBN is equally legitimate. That's a healthier kind of scrutiny.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Go check some ISBNs.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.